The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. Miles to travel before I sleep.
Welcome to All Things Crime.
Joe, hey, welcome to All Things Crime.
Hey, good afternoon, Jared. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I appreciate you coming on.
Absolutely. Glad to do it.
Yeah, for my audience here, I want to introduce Joe Kennedy to you. And I'll tell you, of all the people across the United States, this is one of my most anticipated interviews, because Joe Kennedy is not only a good friend, but he's also an experienced investigator in homicides and in cold cases, especially with NCIS. So he has a wealth of information. And yeah, excited to have you on, Joe.
Hey, thank you, Jared. Again, I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's jump into it. Why don't you start with telling us what your background is? How did you end up in law enforcement?
Yeah, Jared, it certainly wasn't something that I sat down and planned out, you know, as a young man. My dream was to play baseball at the highest level. And, I played a little college baseball. I actually played for the winningest coach in North Carolina history, a guy named Joe Farabee. And I went to a very small school, Pfeiffer College. It's now Pfeiffer University. And so, you know, as you come to graduating, you realize that, hey, you just are not good enough to move on to the next level, right? Not good enough to get drafted or play professionally or something like that. So, I had majored in criminal justice. I had an interest in some of the classes. And so, after graduating, I was with the state police here in North Carolina for a short time, and then I went with NCIS. I can't say any of that was by design. You know, it was really just kind of, okay, that's, you know, who was hiring at the time. And one thing that appealed to me, I grew up in a little town in North Carolina known as High Point, North Carolina. It's where they make all the furniture. And, my dad worked in the furniture factories. My mom worked in the drugstore. So, you know, my optic of the world was very small, you know, other than maybe an occasional, I think we, you know, left, you know, other than me playing, you know, baseball in college throughout the southeastern part of the United States. You know, I really hadn't been anywhere in NCIS. You know, it appealed to me because you could travel, you know, and I remember going in when I had my first interview and this guy showed me this postcard with a photograph of one of the other agents in Hong Kong, you know, and I'm like, wow, you know, that intrigued me. I spent about 30 years with NCIS. I will tell you that it was a blessing from God, you know, because of the places that I was able to go and the things I was able to do. Working on various continents. But my forte, I first started out doing a lot of undercover narcotics work. And a lot of that came from, you know, where I grew up as a kid, you know, in a pretty economically depressed area of the city, and being able to talk to people, move around, you know, I don't want to say high crime areas, but moderate crime areas. And so, you know, that worked for me because I knew the lingo and I knew what the culture was from having avoided it, you know, as a young man, because it was all around me. And so after that, I kind of got my first taste of working homicides, and then I was hooked, you know, forever. And in the fall of 1994, I was actually assigned to our headquarters at NCIS in Washington, D.C. And I had just moved there from Charleston, and I was the case agent for the Joseph Martin Luther Gardner case. Missing McLaughlin was a victim there. It's a very horrific case. We ended up, the state of South Carolina ended up executing Mr. Gardner in December of 2008. But based on that case, I had come to our headquarters and I was working, and one of the other agents approached me that had been assigned with me in Charleston. And her name was Jean Marie Centel. And she said, hey, the boss wants you to look at this case because it's very similar to the Missy McLaughlin case. And I said, well, you know, I'll take a look at it. And of course I was, you know, had other duties going on. And so when I looked at the case, there were some eerie similarities. And this was a case that had originated out of the Virgin Islands in St. Thomas. And in June of 1993, the U.S. naval ship made a port visit there, and two naval officers, they took, you know, they left the ship to go out and, you know, enjoy the city. And so as they went to an ATM, they were viciously attacked by three guys. You know, one of them had a gun. The other one had a baseball bat with some nails driven through the end of it. And so they were attacked, you know, for the money at the ATM, and ended up the one naval officer, Dana Bartlett, died. And so that case, really a lot of effort was put into it for about 18 months, you know, by not only NCIS, the local FBI office, the local Virgin Islands Police Department. And then, you know, they really, you know, due to various reasons the cases go cold, you know, they just didn't get a lot of success with it. So, you know, fortunate for me, when Jean Marie brought me the case, I said, yes, it does look very similar to the Gardner case. Multiple suspects, very vicious crime, you know, not a lot of witnesses around at the time. And so I said, yeah, I'll take a look at it. Well, my direct boss at the time, Jerry Nance, and the director of NCIS, Roy Nedro, both just fantastic guys that had really good vision. You know, a lot of leaders don't have vision. Both of those gentlemen had, you know, they knew, hey, the case, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, hey, that's solvable. You know, to me, I look at it, and I think we can solve it. So long story short, we put together a team, and we went down to the Virgin Islands. We, you know, we read the case for about 5 or 6 weeks to get up to speed on it, and then we flew down in January, and, you know, we were lucky enough to get the case solved in 33 days. So, you know, it had been going on for about a year and a half. And then from there, when I came back to my headquarters, you know, it's kind of like, hey, tag, you're it, right? And so they looked at me and said, hey, you guys had some successes. What do you think we should do with some of these other cold cases we have? And so, you know, of course, you know, cold cases get in your blood really quick, especially when you have a success. I mean, it's, you know, everybody's euphoric. Everybody's happy. You know, you're excited. And this is a misnomer, Jared. The family never gets closure. And that's the thing I hear the most often in law enforcement is even guys that work cold cases for years saying, yeah, we're going to give the family closure. The family never gets closure. They get resolution that, you know, the perpetrators, you know, that person's never coming back. So, you know, from that point, my director and Mr. Nance, who was my direct boss at the time, they kind of said, hey, look, go out and let's solve some more cases. And I said, well, you know, we, I don't want to say stumble through the first one because, you know, we just did the things that I had done my whole career is, you know, solid investigative steps. You know, there's only three ways to solve a murder, right? You have to have an eyewitness, you have to have physical evidence, or you have to have a confession. And so that's what we centered on with that whole case, you know, in the reinvestigation. And so as I started going through files, we had about 305 cold cases at the time. And I thought, well, wow, how do we pick one? You know, how do we pick the next one? And so it dawned on me that, man, yeah, we got, I don't want to say lucky, you make your own luck, but I need to develop a methodology and a protocol. So from that day, I went out to about 15 different police departments throughout the country, you know, San Diego, California, Boston, Metro Dade, Miami, and, you know, met different people who had some great success with cold cases. And they essentially, you know, I was a younger person at the time and they became my mentors. You know, and I looked up to them because they had solved, you know, not just one or two cold cases, but many. And one of the guys that comes to my mind was David Rivers. You know, he was a sergeant at Metro Dade, Miami. And so I asked him, I said, David, you've been working cold cases. You know, Metro Dade's been doing this since 1988. Of course, I'm talking to him in 95, the summer of 95. And they had solved 130 cold cases in those, you know, 7 years. So I thought, well, what's your recipe? And he said, well, I really don't have it. You know, I've got some notes and I've got these. So I took that in all of my visits and I really sat down and wrote a methodology and protocol. And, it, you know, it took me about 6 weeks to actually just do the writing. And so when I came back, a group of agents and myself, we went down to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia, and kicked off our NCIS cold case squad. You know, to where, and then we had some pretty good successes those first, you know, first years, the inaugural years, you know, and people will say, well, you got the low hanging fruit or some, you know, evidence, cases that may have had DNA evidence or what have you. That's very true, but we had some good success. And, you know, I'm proud of that because today that same methodology and protocol is in place. And I think as an agency, NCIS has solved about 85 cold cases in 25 years. I mean, it's not, you know, when you think of the numbers, that's 85 families that because of the protocol I'm doing it. And then one of the things I really enjoyed is from there, you know, I started getting involved in sharing our successes at NCIS with other law enforcement agencies. And that basically took that global. You know, in 2000, I went over to the Netherlands and helped the Dutch set up their cold case squad. You know, I've helped the Philippines, Japan, Brazil. I mean, there's just several places, you know, internationally. And then of course there was a demand signal in the US from agencies wanting me to help set up squads. And, you know, the thing about working a cold case or solving a homicide Jared, is you don't ever do that by yourself, right? Mm-hmm. It is a team approach. And so anything that we were doing was not our original ideas. It's stuff, you know, even as I was investigating, it's stuff that I took from old detectives, you know, old school detectives that were on the way out the door as I was coming in, you know, that mentored me. And so, and that was the same for our team members, you know, and that's so important when you're working a cold case or any homicide, is you really, you have to check your ego at the door. You know, you might be, you might get that guy to confess on one case, you might find a critical piece of evidence, but it truly is, you know, I like to tell people this, I've never solved a homicide. You know, I've been involved in a lot of homicides I've gotten solved, but I've never solved one myself. And, you know, sure, I've had cases where I was, you know, the sole contributor to the majority of the case, but you can't look at it like that. Everybody brings a little piece to the table. And, you know, from there, my career took me, you know, at various places with NCIS. I've been deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq, the Southern Philippines. I mean, you name it. I've worked on everything from transnational crime. You know, one of my last assignments is we were chasing the pirates, you know, that were, you know, abducting ships out in the Gulf, you know, in the Indian Ocean and over there, and the Somali pirates and you know, cold cases. That has been kind of my major thrust and background, though. And I retired in 2014. I was the special agent in charge at NCIS at Camp Lejeune. And that's, you know, arguably either there or Camp Pendleton are our two busiest offices. And, you know, I had to have about 100 people between the two states of North and South Carolina. And so, you know, when it was, you know, my term was over, you know, I had done my career. I wanted to move back to Central North Carolina, where I'm from. And so I did that. I partnered up with, there's about 15 of us, retired local, state, and federal. We're part of a training group that does advanced law enforcement training throughout the state of North Carolina, known as Blue Line. And then aside from that, I have, since the mid-1990s, I have been part of the North Carolina Homicide Investigators Association. And that group is a state homicide, and the group that was the sole purpose, when its origin is when it was, you know, spawned in 94, it was for agencies in the state to come together and talk about unsolved cases. You know, I had been involved in that over the years. And interestingly, before I got involved in cold cases in 95, I was working, you know, several violent crimes and murders down in Charleston. And the office manager at that time, a lady named Elaine Kelly, there was an unsolved case from 1980 that had happened. You know, a sailor was murdered on the base there in Charleston. And so after we had some successes with some cases, I'll never forget, you know, it's probably about 1990, early 90 or 91. She walks in and brings the file and hands it to me. And she says, y'all solve these other, when are you going to solve this one? You know, ironically, that case is still unsolved today. But, you know, and that kind of gnawed at me because we were overwhelmed. I was assigned to a violent crime task force down there known as Weed and Seed, a Department of Justice Weed and Seed program. And, you know, we were just so busy with cases and other murders and violent crimes that I never really got a chance to put the optic on it that I wanted to. But when I did, you know, we couldn't advance it to a successful stage. But I know maybe I'm going around and around here with you a lot, but, you know, it's my passion even today. So I'm part of the Carolina's Cold Case Coalition, and we basically cover North and South Carolina. The uniqueness of that organization, you know, you've got a lot of cold case groups that have popped up across the country, so-called volunteers. And the uniqueness of our organization is you have to be retired local, state, or federal law enforcement to participate in it. We do have a few folks from academia, some specialists and experts, but predominantly. But half of our coalition is active detectives that are still working cases. And so we concentrate on some of the rural areas in North and South Carolina, a lot of small departments that lack the resources, the manpower, the knowledge, the expertise to get a cold case over the hump. You know, Jared, a lot of people don't understand how hard it is to solve a cold case. And I want you to think about this. I just want to share this one stat with you. Only 1 in 5 cold cases will you have a conclusively identified suspect. Only 1 in 20 cold cases will a prosecutor decide to prefer charges or go to a grand jury for indictment. But only 1 in 100 cold cases will actually result in conviction. Is that not an astounding number? I mean, it's really hard, and a lot of people don't understand it. Now, one thing that's kind of popped up today, and I'm sure maybe your viewers will be fully aware of this, is forensic genealogy has become a game changer for cold cases, right? It has, because I can tell you up until, you know, the first 25 years that I was involved in cold case work, there was no forensic genealogy that you could tap into. The interesting thing is in about, and think of this stat, in about 95% of cold cases, the suspect's name is listed in the file. Now that's, and when you think about that, and often it's listed in the file within the first 30 days of the investigation or the first 10% of the case file. So when you think of those numbers, and sometimes law enforcement's on the correct path, right? They're chasing the right bad guy. There's just not enough evidence or information to be able to seek, you know, seek an arrest warrant. But in some of them, there's multiple suspects, or there's, you know, it's, how do you weed out? You have so many suspects. How do you weed them out and get to the correct suspect? And that's one thing that forensic genealogy is doing, is it is finding those so-called ghost suspects. You know, when you think of the Golden State Killer, D'Angelo is a ghost suspect. He's not in the file. And that's not the norm, because in 95% of cold cases, the suspect's listed somewhere in the file. Maybe law enforcement's talked to him. Maybe they missed talking to him, but his name was recorded. You know, so it's kind of, and I really am, I'm so excited about forensic genealogy right now, because it is becoming a game changer for some of those ghost suspects. I'm sorry, Jared. I know I was a little long-winded there, but I'll shut up now.
Oh no, I that's what this thing's all about, man. It's learning about you, and you know, you're a wealth of information and a wealth of knowledge and experience. And so, no, I am more than happy to just be quiet and let the expert talk.
Well, I mean, you know, Jared, and I'm not exactly sure, you know, what your viewers are most interested in. I will tell you that, you know, there is, and as we wrote the methodology and protocol, 25 years ago, here's the interesting thing. The only thing that's changed is forensic genealogy. That's it. Yeah. And so, but you have to be very methodical with a cold case. If you think of it like this, you know, a hot homicide is kind of like playing checkers, right? I mean, you have to respond, you have to interview witnesses, you have to, and you have to try to do it quickly because, you know, time's not on your side. But with a cold case, what you should be thinking about is playing chess. You have to be very strategic in your moves. And one of the things, and I'm starting to see a little bit more of it with forensic genealogy, say in terms of like surreptitious collection of DNA, you know, we've got to be more creative, you know, in the cold case arena. And that's what we always fashioned ourselves at NCIS is, you know, we wanted to, and we use the term operationalize a case, so that when we knock on that suspect's door 10, 15, 20 years later, we have the element of surprise and they're going, oh my gosh, you are here to talk to me about that murder I did. And they haven't read it on the news. They haven't heard it from other witnesses. You know, no one's tipped them off that we're coming. Because as I said at the start, you know, there's only three ways to solve a murder. You know, you've got to have a witness, you've got to have physical evidence, or you have to get them to confess. A lot of cold cases come down to getting the person to confess. You know, you have to give them a reason to confess, though. Now, I want to just real quickly touch on the three foundational blocks of cold cases if I can. And, you know, it's like building a house. Please. You know, Jared, when you're building a house, you got to have a strong house. So the foundation, you know, is important. And in that foundation, there's three pillars of cold case. The first one's time. And in a hot homicide, time is our enemy, right? A lot of homicide detectives will allude to the fact, hey, you got about 48, 72 hours to solve a case. And then your chances of solving it start declining rapidly. You know, time's our enemy. But what we have to do with a cold case is we turn that negative of time into our ally, right? And how we do that is it's one simple thing, and that is relationships change. You know, boyfriend and girlfriend of yesteryear, okay, maybe they've split now. Or, okay, husband and wife have divorced now. You know, the wife knew, hey, the husband did that murder, but she wasn't about to say anything, you know, during the time of the murder because, you know, maybe that she depended on the husband's livelihood or she was afraid of that, you know, whatever the circumstances might be. But what we find with cold cases, and a lot of people are astounded when I go to departments and we start looking through, there's certain clues in a file, an investigative file that'll give you a, you know, what's going on. And it's, they always tell somebody, the perpetrators. And it's not like they go and, you know, 5 years later, they tell their next door neighbor, yeah, I killed that little girl down in, you know, Mississippi when I was, you know, but what they do is they give information that directly contradicts what they told the original investigators during the initial investigation. Like maybe they told the original investigators, no, I didn't see the victim that night. I was down at the bowling alley. Yet when you go back and find all these witnesses in the suspect's life since the murder, and all of a sudden, let's say you find a neighbor that was his neighbor, let's say 10 years after the murder, and they say, yeah, you know, we were drinking beer like one night on the picnic table, and he did say that he was a suspect in this murder case in Mississippi because he was the last one to see the victim alive. And you go, whoa, wait a minute. In the police file, he clearly said, no, I didn't see the, you know, I was bowling. I didn't see the victim. But now you have this. And so that's how it typically works, you know, and it reveals itself. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different clues in a case, but that foundation of time, we have to take that thing and we have to turn it into an ally for us. And then we have to take people from the past also and incorporate them into massaging investigative leads and theories and, you know, to get the right angle to go back at the suspect. The next one is tenacity. You know, and most cops have that. But cold case is not for every police officer or investigator. Some people get into it and they just don't like it because it is tedious. It is time consuming. Mm-hmm. It is frustrating, right? And, you know, because you will do a million things for one little chance to, you know, get the suspect to say confess or, you know, surreptitiously get some DNA or whatever. So tenacity is the second, you know, building block. And it's so important that when you're working cases that you understand, man, I got to work this thing day and night. And then lastly is technology. And cops don't know enough about technology. I'm going to use your MBAC as an example, right? What a piece of equipment. Oh my gosh. You know, when you think about and you're in a room, I say this everywhere I go and talk about cold cases. One of the first things I tell them to do is, hey, run your evidence back through MBAC or determine if MBAC is suitable for it. And when I give them the analogy of sweeping up a room with a broom or taking a vacuum and going over a room very methodically, it hits them like a brick. Oh, wow. And I don't think a lot of people understand that just you, and I'm not saying this because it's your machine. It's the truth. It's such a good piece of equipment because crime labs, all they want to do is process evidence. You know, they have to get, you know, they know, okay, once I process this piece of evidence, hey, I got, you know, hundreds more pieces of evidence on other cases. And so it's not that they're rushing, but it's, they don't have the time to use great pieces of equipment like the MVAC, you know, where they would have to go over an entire shirt instead of just putting it under an ultraviolet light and concentrating on little, you know, swabs on areas of interest. And, you know, that's one of the best tools that we've had come to cold case is your MVAC. And people that use it understand it, you know. And is it going to work on every case? Absolutely not, right? But the DNA is not there all the time. But right. Just understanding today forensic genealogy, there's so many police officers and there's so many cold case investigators that have no knowledge of forensic genealogy, very limited. And it just blows me away because I'm like, wow, the Golden State Killer was 2 years ago. We've been doing this, you know, in the nation and we've had some great successes. That's the successes you're seeing right now. It's all forensic genealogy. Now, I will say this, I'm a little concerned because I think everybody thinks, wow, forensic genealogy is going to solve my case. Mm-hmm. We have to keep in mind, Jared, there's about 280,000 unsolved murders in this country. That is an astronomical number. If we just went back to 1990, the resolution rate for homicides was about 67%. Today, do you know the resolution rate for murder in America is hovering just under 60%? 59.4, 59.7, depending on what the FBI, you know, how they want to type it a certain day. So as you can see, now a lot of people don't understand too. They think, well, crime is off the charts and it's soaring. And that's true. But this country peaked in murders around 1992, 1993. We averaged right about 24,000 murders. And if you think about, I'm just going to give you a stat from say 2016, 2018, 16,000, 17,000 murders. You know, we're not even hitting 18,000 murders yet. So, you know, but nonetheless, think that we're only solving a little over, you know, right at 60%. So this is not going away. You know, cold case is here to stay. It's been here for, you know, decades. I think we're going to have more cold cases. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But the biggest reason is bystander behavior. You know, if you went back into the 40s, 50s and 60s in the country, people cooperated with the police. Mm-hmm. And it starts, you know, there's less cooperation in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Well, today, oh my goodness, Jared, nobody wants to tell the police anything. And I don't know why, I don't understand that because any of us in law enforcement, all we're trying to do is, you know, we're not in this for the money. Anybody in law enforcement certainly didn't get into it for the money or for a career or advancing or financial wealth or any of that. You know, most, you know, and do we have bad cops? Sure. Every profession has bad apples. But I can tell you that, you know, 95% of the cops are here to, you know, do a public service, try to be involved in something that's, you know, maybe greater than them or a greater cause than, you know, their personal selves. But, you know, I'm excited about cold cases. I'm helping on a case. It's, you know, before you call, I'm helping a gentleman. It's unfortunate his daughter is murdered in Illinois, you know, it's about 8 years ago. And so I'm walking through and I'm working with another investigator. And we're trying to get a strategy together because it's a solvable case. It's a very solvable case. So we're trying to get a strategy that we can put in place, you know, and I've never taken drugs in my life. So I don't know, you know, what it feels like to take drugs. But, you know, when you solve a case or you're involved with a family, because, you know, that's what people miss, you know, to me, I lost both of my parents in 1990. My dad died of a stroke. My mom died of cancer. I lost an 8-year-old nephew that year that got hit by a car, and my uncle hung himself. And then my grandmother died on Christmas Eve of natural causes. So I lost 5 people in 16 months. And so to me, that was the turning point for me because it made me realize how precious life is. And when I'm working these cold cases and I'm thinking, God, I've got my own personal issues with, you know, everybody in my family is dropping dead around me. But, you know, nothing from nefarious acts, obviously, but it just gave me an appreciation that, you know what, man, it is so precious that, you know, and again, it's not going to give a family closure, but that's what drives me is, can we go out? Can we get a case solved? I don't care who gets the credit. I don't care. You know, I don't want any, you know, and that's the way we operate. We try to operate in anonymity today, that if we help a police department solve a case, they cannot say that we help them, you know, at our coalition. Mm-hmm. No, you can't say that these guys, because, you know, we've all worked cases for years and we've had our day in the sun. So we want to mentor, help train these young detectives, these new detectives, you know, they're new cold case investigators. And so that's kind of what drives me. And I get excited when I see some of them picking up on what they should do, you know, and making it work. You know, here in North Carolina, I had worked with a detective just a few times. And then he called me, you know, a couple months ago and he said, hey, I did A, B, and C, like we discussed, and guess what? I got the case solved. I got the district attorney to indict the guy, and I'm like, wow, that's awesome, you know, because he, and now he'll take that on and train other investigators, and he'll use that success, you know, so it's like a self-licking ice cream cone, and that's my motivation today is, hey, what can we do to help get cases solved? And it just comes down to, you know, life is really precious to me. I have no hobbies. Jared, I have my wife and I have been together 40 years. The only thing we do, we got a border collie named Lucy. And that border collie is, if anybody's ever had a border collie, they're fixated on one thing. They catch frisbees, they catch balls, they chase cows, whatever that. Our dog plays tennis ball. And so, you know, every day we're out. And so aside from that, it's really the only hobby I have. You know, I get up very early in the mornings a lot of days and I'm looking at cases, you know, getting texts all through the weekend. You know, my wife's just used to it, you know, after 35 years, she's like, okay, you know, and so, you know, but I don't mind it at all. If we can help somebody solve a case or get somebody a resource, you know, that's what we want to try to do.
Well, Joe, that sums it up right there. I honestly, I think you really hit it when you said law enforcement officers aren't in this for the money. They're in it for the satisfaction of being able to help other people. Yes, there's a few that are in it for the wrong reasons, but I think the vast majority of the 650, 700,000 law enforcement officers in the U.S., that's why they're in it, is because they want to serve their community. They want to accomplish things. Sure, there's obvious advantages and pros and cons to every profession, including law enforcement. But having been a part of it for the last decade or so, and helping solve cold cases like what you're describing there, there's a level of satisfaction and excitement and just fulfillment that I didn't get in any of the other things that I did prior to becoming involved with MBAC systems, and especially once we pivoted into forensics. But there's one thing that I want to hit on before I let you go. You were talking about and I think this is just so fascinating, and I can't think of anybody else that could answer this question better. What is it about if a suspect does something and doesn't get caught, And you're talking about, you know, that particular person that moves into another place, gets talking, and may say something differently about the crime itself and about their involvement in it. And it'll be different than what they told the initial investigative officers or something. And it's like, so what is it about? I think guys like me, I look at them and I'm like, why would you ever say anything about it ever again? Do you think that is about? What is it about they need to say something about? They need to tell somebody about their involvement in it.
Yeah, so Jared, what I would say is, you know, there are people who never tell a soul. You know, I don't want to mislead your audience. There's certainly those people, you know, those suspects that they do it and never tell anybody. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is I have talked to a number of suspects, you know, after we have, you know, either got a confession from them or proved through DNA that they were responsible for the murder. And every one of them, Jared, without exception, they cannot get it out of their mind. Okay, so in other words, let's say the victim was in a blue Chevy Silverado. Every time they see a blue Chevy Silverado on the, you know, as they're out living their lives, they think of it. Or let's say the victim had blonde hair and wore it, you know, a certain style. Every time they see a blonde female with her hair in that style, they think about it. And they can't, it's like taking a digital picture. Right now, years ago, before we had digital cameras, suspects would tell me, hey, it's like taking a Polaroid photograph. Some of your viewers don't even know what a Polaroid is, but it's a modern day digital camera. And so that's the way they would describe it. And they can't live with it. And here's the thing, Jerry, this is something I'll leave you with is so many murders are not planned. And this is what people don't, this is, there's a big misunderstanding of this. The other crimes are planned. Hey, the robbery's planned. The break-in is planned. The sexual assault is planned, but what they don't plan on is how the victim is going to respond. So yeah, they see the little old lady carrying her purse down the road and they go to jerk that thing away from her. And they don't realize she's a feisty little old lady like my wife, right? Who's mean and feisty, and they got a fight on their hands. And so then as they get into that fight, the little old lady trips and hits her head on the back of the concrete gutter and dies. Right. And so it's not a planned event. And people would be surprised of how few murders are planned. But unfortunately, true crime television makes it look like all these cases are planned because those are the ones that sell popcorn. Right. Those are the ones that, you know, there's some malice and a forethought and planning. But most murders are not planned. Hmm. You know, the other thing when you talk about murders, remember 8 out of 9 murders are committed by people who know the suspect and the victim. There's a prior interpersonal relationship. Might be a slight, you know, prior interpersonal relationship, but there's you know, stranger on stranger crime is very rare. But I guess I would sum it up. The people that we have talked to, you know, and relayed, when I say people, the suspects we have talked to have relayed to us that I can't get it off my mind. I can't get it. I can't, because I didn't plan to kill them. And they're oftentimes not lying. You know, they plan to go do the other nefarious act. They didn't realize it was going to result in someone dying. So it's very hard. And it causes the neuron transmitters in the back of your brain to get out of whack when you kill somebody. And it's kind of like when you've been up studying for a test or you just blank out driving down the street. I mean, murdering someone has a profound effect on you. You know, that's far different than, I mean, because just what our society too, the negative implication of that. So it's hard for these people to live with it. And of course, as a cold case investigator, Jared, what we want to do is force them to relive it so they'll confess to us. Because that's then you start gnawing at them. Hey, here's the old photos of the neighborhood where it happened, and you know here's the family that lived next to you. So you can see them in interviews actually reliving the stuff. I love to put photographs on the table of a victim, because if they didn't do it, they don't need to keep looking at the photograph. But what you'll find is suspects that have done the murder, they can't get their eyes off that picture of that victim. They're like, look. They know you're watching them. And so then, or when you turn to them discreetly, you know, because it's just in their mind to relive it. But I hope that helps explain, you know, or answer your question. I hope that was what you were looking for, because that's what it is.
Yeah. Well, I was just kind of wondering if it possibly talking about it is almost like self-therapy, where sometimes they can, again, talk themselves into, well, it was justified, or you know, it wasn't my fault, or, you know, something like that. And it's just, I think the psychological reasons, like what you said, killing somebody actually takes a rearranging of your neurons and your whole mindset. Most people just can't do it. And that's why, you know, as you know, I have a military background. And one of the things that that they always talked about is if you ever go to war, there's a psychological switch that has to flip in order for a lot of soldiers to actually pull that trigger. And that's why dehumanizing the other side is so important. And it's interesting that if you go throughout history, even all the way back to the Revolutionary War, for example, the British weren't called British, they were called Redcoats. And that's because it dehumanizes them, and therefore it enables a normal farm boy that has been conscripted into the American Army at the time was able to pull the trigger. And he said, because you're not killing a person, you're killing a redcoat. And redcoats are bad. And every single war since then, that's kind of what has to happen. And just as a side note, it's kind of scary right now that we're not even at war, and yet there's some dehumanization of what's going on with people that disagree with you politically. And yes. And I think that's actually a very dangerous thing that's going on right now in society. But back to the suspect that committed the crime, if he has to psychologically justify it to himself, then I'm wondering if also just talking about it to somebody that may not have any kind of a threat to him, you know, it's like, if I've moved into a completely different area, what's the chance that this guy actually has any details of this case and would even understand that if I tell a different side of the story, the chance of it ever actually getting to an investigator like yourself are so low that it's worth talking about.
Yeah, and you'd be surprised of how many of them tell more than one person, Jerry. They'll tell multiple people through their life, you know, especially some of the old cases that are 20, 30 years old. You know, when you start peeling back the onion, you realize, oh, wow, he told these neighbors, he told this ex-sister-in-law, you know, I mean, and it's, you know, we just had a case this week where the guy's told three people, you know, and then of course the you know, some people think, oh, he's just, you know, he's trying to be a tough guy and take responsibility for the murder because it was a very high crime area where it happened. You know, no, he wasn't. He truly did it, you know, but that was their perception at the time. Oh, he would just brag, you know, and then as things have come about, they realize, oh, wait a minute, he probably did do it. But yeah, and you're making a very good point, Jared. I've never really thought of it like that. Or is it almost like self-therapy? I mean, that's a great point you're bringing up. I don't know. My guess is like you. Yeah, I'll bet you there's some validity to that.
Well, shoot, Joe, now you got some homework. You can go back to brainstorming with all your other experts over there, and you guys can put your heads together and maybe come up with an answer to that and add that to your book.
Yeah, I will do that, Jared. And you know, one thing that I want to say to you, you know, I mean, you're an ex-military guy and you know, you get it, but I think you fall in line too. And there are a lot of people like you that are out there that are doing great things for the criminal justice system that don't get any credit. I mean, think of how many cases think of that significant case, that 18-year-old case where you processed that rock. I think that was in your home state of Utah, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, that family would have never gotten there without you and your dad's invention. And you know, I applaud you guys for what you're doing because, you know, I've met with you and worked with you over the years. And, you know, some people are in business for money. And I think, yes, you've got to make a living. But I get the vibe from you the same thing. I know your heart's in the right place and you're out just trying to get cases solved. And we appreciate it. We really do because we're always looking for that next thing, that whatever that thing is that can help us solve a case. And it's mind blowing to me that we don't have more MVACs out, you know, because everywhere I go, I say, hey, you get MVACs. And of course in North Carolina, I think we've got, you know, five or six now, which is good because we didn't have any. And right. I know they're being used. You know, I was last week, I was with our State Bureau of Investigation and, you know, a guy said, yeah, I took this down and had the MVAC done in Guilford County. And I'm like, great. You know, it's working. People are, you know, using it. So, we applaud you for what you're doing with your company, and I mean that. We appreciate it.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you actually saying that because my dad, when he invented it back in late 90s, it was all about collecting E. coli and helping make the food industry safer so that we didn't have a repeat of that 1993 E. coli outbreak. But as we pivoted into forensics, obviously, Dad's not with us anymore, but one of our good friends who used to work for us, his name's Jared Mond, said it in a in another video that we made a while back. And he said, you know, I, even though Dr. Bradley, you know, dad originally envisioned the MVAC helping the food industry, said, I think he would be very pleased to see the work that it's doing in the forensics industry now and helping solve cases, whether it be cold cases or active cases. It doesn't matter, because on the end of every single case is a victim and a victim's family. And they are the ones, even more than society, more than people on the periphery like me, even more than the investigators, the family needs to find, like you said, they're not going to find closure, but having some kind of an ending where they can say, yes, at least I know what happened to my loved one. To me, there is really nothing more fulfilling than that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Jared. So keep doing what you're doing, man. And I know you're going to continue to do great things, and we'll keep promoting the MVAC everywhere I go, that's for sure.
Well, the only reason I do what I do is because of guys like you that do what you do. So I appreciate you coming on today, Joe. And man, what a great story you have. And I would love to have you on again. We can tell some more stories and certainly more success stories as you guys are solving more cases out there in North Carolina.
Hey, I'll do it, Jerry. God bless you.
You too. Thanks, sir.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to All Things Crime. We are so grateful for all of our listeners. If you enjoyed this, please give us a positive review so other people can find it as well. Have an amazing All Things Crime Day.
Finding the right person for the job isn't easy. Just ask someone who hired a lounge singer to be their office receptionist.
Hello, this is Mickey Marquis, and you've reached the office of Duggan Associates. Thank you very much. Catch me Tuesday nights at the Hotel Johnson. Hello?
But if you've got an insurance question, you can always count on your local GEICO agent. They can bundle your policies, which could save you hundreds.
Duggan Associates, this is Mickey Marquis. Hello?
For expert help with all your insurance needs, visit geico.com/local today.